Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Vincent Hannum
and Matt Levine.
And we're talking about all our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts, welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by BanditsEmporium.com, where you can shop exclusive monster-inspired t-shirts with a part of the proceeds supporting this show. BanditsEmporium.com, hit the link in our bio. As they say, we sell shirts. As Camp Kaiju says, stay campy, everybody.
The motion picture screen explodes with unprecedented power as the two masters of imagination, Jules Verne and Walt Disney, join to bring you a shattering new experience in entertainment. Read by countless millions, translated into 18 languages, this classic adventure is a story of measureless scope, fraught with fantastic beauty and danger. Four great stars give the spark of life to its leading characters in a series of inspirational performances. Kirk Douglas as the master harpooner, Ned Land.
Got a whale of a tale to tell you, lads. A whale of a tale or two about the flatfoot fish and the girls I've loved on nights like this with the moon above. A whale of a tale, and it's all true, I swear by my tattoo.
James Mason is Captain Nemo, who held the destiny of the world in his hands.
The real story of the ocean depths begins where you left off. Wonders defy my powers of description. The secrets that are mine alone.
Paul Lucas as Professor Aronnax of the Paris Institute.
I asked you to leave, Professor. You also asked me ashore to show me man's inhumanity to man. Why? To justify this? You are not only a murderer, you are a hypocrite. The proof lies out there.
You call that murder?
Peter Lorre as Conseil.
Sure we're friends.
Go ahead. Hit me. Huh? Hit me.
You mean that?
Sure, go ahead. You can't miss it. Now we are friends.
The most vivid scenes from the novel become unforgettable on the screen. The luxurious interior of the submarine. The revelation of the hidden mysteries of the deep.
We do our hunting and farming here.
And the water?
The sea supplies all my wants.
The mighty harvests of the ocean kingdom. And the strange creatures that menace the intruders on the ocean floor. And after a safe return, the memorable dinner party.
It's remarkable. This tastes like veal.
The flavor deceives you. That is fillet of sea snake.
I guess this isn't lamb.
That is brisket of blowfish with sea squirt dressing, basted in barnacles.
What is it?
It's a recipe of my own. Sauté of unborn octopus.
And to stay in your memory as the most thrilling sequence ever photographed in motion picture history, the terrifying battle with the giant squid.
Hi, gang, it's Patrick.
And JT.
Coming up on today's episode, we're diving deep into the movie 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea with special guest Vincent from the Camp Kaiju podcast. As always, we discuss the latest Disney news and we close out the show with some quick D. All that and more on today's episode of Gays Do the D.
To all who come to this happy place, welcome.
Tweedles, one and all, we are diving deep today in the I don't want to know. Do I want to say fantastic movie in the movie, the classic Disney movie?
A fantasy movie.
A fantasy SEA movie, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. But we have a very special guest with us today, and that is my dear friend, Vincent, who is a co-host of the podcast Camp Kaiju. Vincent, welcome to Gays Do the D.
Hey, thanks, Patrick. Thanks, JT, for having me. Thank you, all you Tweedles, for already putting up with me and my shenanigans. I am the co-host and producer of Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews.
Okay, so tell us what that is all about. I know about your podcast because I happen to enjoy you as a friend, and I enjoy your podcast, and I enjoy monsters. But some of our Tweedles may not know, so and JT may not know. So let us know what your podcast is all about.
You assume I'm ignorant.
Yeah. You all said it, not me. Well, Camp Kaiju, we review monster movies, old and new, classic, traditional kaiju like Godzilla and Mothra and those types of wonderful movies. But then we do dive into stranger beasts of all sorts of shapes and sizes. We just released our latest episode about the 1994 Jack Nicholson movie called Wolf.
Oh, yeah. I know that movie.
Love that movie, actually. Yeah.
Really? I had never heard of it, but my co-host Matt, he brought it to the podcast. We alternate movies. And yeah, we talk about the film in regards to the good aspects, quote unquote, the bad aspects, and the campy aspects. So we have a lot of fun, but we do try to treat the movies with a certain film analysis bent.
Right.
So
yeah.
Looking at it through a cultural or societal lens, and see if it stands the test of time. Ultimately,
I love that. In fact, I was on an episode that is maybe not one of your more regular episodes where we reviewed the movie Luca, because it is, of course, about sea monsters, and that was a lot of fun. And we had some interesting conversation, I have to say, on that episode.
Yeah. I think monsters, in particular, as a genre, offer so much metaphor that you might think, oh yeah, it's obvious that the wolfman or werewolves are metaphors for finding identity or sexuality. But actually, it's not always the first thing that comes to people's minds. They just are enjoying a good horror movie, which is absolutely legit. But Matt and I on our show, we like to dig a little deeper into those themes.
I love it. The closest we get to monsters on Gays of the D is having a cisgendered heterosexual male as a guest on our show.
Hey, that's me.
So welcome, Vincent. Yeah.
That's me. Yeah. And I it's truly an honor to be a guest on Gays Do the D. So yeah, whatever nonsense I spout, just take it with a grain of salt, because I am a cisgendered male here.
We forgive you. So before we get into the movie, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, we do this with all of our guest hosts on the show, and we want to get sort of your dystery lesson from you. Nothing too deep, but just sort of what is your background, if you have one at all, with the Walt Disney Company?
Oh, do I have a background in my backyard, I should say. So I'm from Orlando. My dad worked for so many different hotels in the Disney theme parks. And if he wasn't working at one, I always had a friend who worked at one. I worked at the Contemporary Hotel for a real hot minute before I got fired, but that's a story for another time. I resigned, I should say, my position. So I always had access to the theme parks, very privileged to have that access, but nice. It was great to go to MGM Studios, as it was known back in the day. That was my favorite. Movie lover here. Yeah. So lot of good memories at the theme park there.
Awesome. Do you have a favorite Disney movie or genre of Disney movies even?
Ooh, okay. The first one that came to my mind that's like pure Disney. I'm not talking Pixar or anything.
Sure.
Is The Fox and the Hound.
Always be friends forever.
I'm a fan of that like 70s, 80s low point in the Disney franchise. The Disney canon.
Yeah.
Like Robin Hood.
Yes.
The Adventurers.
The Rescuers.
Rescuers.
Yeah.
Yep. Clearly know that one very well. Oliver and Company, I just rewatched.
Such a good movie.
It's such a weird movie for Disney.
It's not a masterpiece, but
yeah, no,
there's enough.
Yeah, there. It's definitely one of those movies that you can tell, like, oh, all of these artists left immediately after this movie and went on to a very different company that had very similar movies to Oliver and Company.
Yeah.
Oh, I love it. I love it. All right. Well, welcome. Thank you so much for being here. This is a movie that we wouldn't necessarily review on Gays Do the D. This is, in fact, our first foray into doing a classic live action movie here on the show. We're 200 some episodes in it. We've never reviewed a classic live action movie. And so this is right up your alley because it's about monsters. And JT, this is right up your alley because on your podcast, The Disney Buzz, you often review classic live action Disney movies. So
we do.
I am the new one to the game here. So you'll all have to sort of lead me in. I do want to start. I want to preface what we're about to talk about in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea by saying there is a very problematic scene in this movie that really rubbed me the wrong way in when they went and saw the quote unquote the natives and or the cannibals basically on an island. They are depicted, and I just want to give this as a plug of like, we are not endorsing this. They are depicted. I don't want to use the word racist because I think it was just an uneducated lens in which they portrayed these characters, sort of like they portrayed the characters and then we did away with them in The Jungle Cruise, right? In the ride, I mean. And that they're very primitive and very just, you know, the non-white folks in the movie were not depicted very well.
It's a 1954 lens.
It is, yeah. And we're not making excuses for it,
no.
But we are saying it wasn't okay then, it is not okay now, and I think we can maybe skip that part of the movie. In fact, you could skip that part of the movie because it had nothing to do with the movie at all, I would say. Like, it added very little value to the movie, in my opinion. What do you guys think?
I totally agree. That the movie could have been about 10 minutes, 15 minutes shorter without that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if we're... The length of this film, it's a long one.
It is.
It's an epic in every sense of the word.
Yeah.
But yeah, especially when you're considering the diversity of this film, when those are your only characters of color. Yeah, does not stand the test of time.
No,
in
certainly.
That regard.
No, certainly doesn't. Okay, so all that being said, we're going to give a quick synopsis of the movie. We're going to get into the cast and crew, some thoughts about it. Vincent's going to give us sort of his take from his podcast lens on what this movie is. And then we'll sort of go into some fun facts and then rate it as we are now want to do on Gaze to the D. A new thing that we're doing here is some ratings. So JT, do you want to kick us into... Or just guide us into what this movie is about, if you can.
I will do my utmost best.
Yeah.
So 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, it's based on this novel by the same name by Jules Verne, which was written in 1870. Jules Verne, of course, also wrote Journey to the Center of the Earth and Around the World in 80 Days. Two of those three books have been Disney attractions and Disney movies. This movie is set in 1868. It starts with rumors of a sea monster that are spreading up and down the Pacific coast. Professor Aronnax and his assistant, Conseil, are asked to investigate these rumors and board a ship along with Master Harpooner Ned Land. Their ship is hit by what they think is the monster, sending all three overboard while they go out to sea and discover what it is. What they thought was the monster is actually a submarine called the Nautilus, and all three board that boat. That boat is captained by a gentleman named Captain Nemo. So they found Nemo.
They did.
Along their adventure in the ship, they discover that Captain Nemo's ship, the Nautilus, is harnessed by atomic power discovered in the island of Vulcania. Did we tell you this was a fantasy? This discovery in the wrong hands would lead to war. Captain Nemo's mission is to sink the ships that carry ammunition to other countries in the hopes of saving thousands of lives. But along the way, he sacrifices the lives of everyone on those ships. A classic tale as old as time.
That's right.
In an attempt to escape the Nautilus, Ned and Conseil send messages in bottles, letting nearby warships know of their plan to head to Vulcania, and also inspiring the Vault song from the Taylor Swift Red album, Message in a Bottle. Along the way there, they are attacked by a giant squid, the actual sea monster, which Master Harpooner Ned fins off.
I want that to be my title. Master Harpooner.
Oh, God.
Thank you.
Master Harpooner Patrick Kosicki. Right. The Nautilus reaches Vulcania, is met by warships who attack them on sight. Not wanting the power of the island to be discovered, Captain Nemo sets up bombs to destroy everything. Earthing. Before he gets back to the Nautilus, he is fatally shot, and he tells the crew that he's decided to sink the Nautilus with everyone on board as the ending to their mission. Literally the epitome of, if I'm going down, you're going down with me.
That's right.
100%. Chaos ensues on the ship, as it does. Professor Aronnax, Conceal, and Master Harpooner Ned all escape as the Nautilus, Captain Nemo, and the crew all sink to the bottom of the ocean.
Just a heartwarming tale, isn't it?
Just full really, of hope.
Just
and
beautiful.
Just, beautiful. Yeah, a beautiful tale of humanity. Yeah. And yeah.
I know I said that we were going to get into the cast and crew next, but actually, I think this is a good place to like start talking about our initial thoughts after we've given this lovely synopsis. Thank you, JT.
You're so welcome.
JT, do you want to, what did you think of this movie? Just initially, like what are your sort of like first round thoughts and opinions?
I mean, just my general opinion of this movie is honestly, in terms of production design, in terms of, you know, the casting, I think it's probably one of the more premier Disney live action movies. I mean, it honestly feels like a movie that really any studio could have put out in the 50s as sort of like a big epic, you know, action adventure. I will say the movie could have been a good tight 85 minutes. There is a lot of, you know, repeating the same sort of motifs over and over again with in this movie. You know, I think there's a couple really good performances. I mean, James Mason, I think his performance is really, really fantastic. We'll get into that when we get into the cast and crew. But, you know, I think his is really great. I think Kirk Douglas is pretty good in this movie. I think for the time, I think the special effects are actually pretty decent, you know, from my perspective.
Yeah.
And probably at that time were incredibly impressive. I mean, this did win an Oscar for special effects. So yeah, I mean, it's a nice diversion. It's not something I have to like have in like a repeat rotation. I think the thing that really cripples it, besides the unnecessary segment of the movie that we've already talked about that we don't need to mention again, is just how long it is. And it just doesn't need to be as long as it is.
It drags.
It clocks in at 127 minutes. Actually, that's only 2 hours, a 2-hour and 7-minute movie.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, in the grand scheme of things.
I thought this was a 3-hour movie when I watched it.
It is the epitome, though, of a slow burn of a movie, though, right? Like so much, like, just like, I don't know, unnecessary conversation and a lot of underwater shots, which are beautiful done for it being shot in the 1950s is incredible, incredible.
Oh, yeah.
But a lot of it was like, okay, do we need 47 shots of this one fish, or could we have done one shot of this fish?
It feels like it turns into like a nature documentary in the middle for like.
Well, some of it was like taken from the old Disney nature documentaries, actually, that they just used in this movie. They just placed it in, so that's why it felt that way, because it was that way. Yeah.
Who told them they had time to kill them?
Right. Exactly. Exactly. What about you, Vincent? What were your sort of initial thoughts of the movie?
Oh man. So I have knocked this movie actually, but my initial thoughts were wonder. I was sucked into the adventure and the over the top action and thrills. Kirk Douglas can really do no wrong in my book. and he perfectly epitomizes that swashbuckling, chip on his shoulder, loose cannon of a sailor. Also, I mean, I'm an actor by trade, so I'm always taken by performances, and James Mason, Peter Lorre is one of my top favorites. The special effects, if we're talking about 1954, yeah, I was especially taken by the Kraken at the end. And may I get into a little
of course
a little monster context here?
That's why we have you on the show.
Okay, so 1954, the original Godzilla came out.
That's right. Another,
so that arguably more of a landmark movie than 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea for like worldwide cinema, but 20,000 Leagues has its place in film history. But anyways, Godzilla is portrayed by a man in a rubber suit. So that's one way to portray a monster. Over in the States, monsters in the early 50s were either portrayed by sort of a stop motion claymation type deal, sort of like King Kong.
Right.
And that was big in the 1950s. Or they filmed live animals and did some editing to make them look larger than life.
They did the scaling aspect, the ratios right. or whatever.
So you can imagine a B-movie version of 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea has an actual octopus like in a tank swimming over little model people.
Right, yeah. Yeah, maybe touching a toy submarine or something.
Right,
yeah.
right. So to see these kind of practical effects in play in 20,000 Leagues, honestly, in my experience watching monster movies, is ahead of its time.
Hmm.
You know, you could think about monster effects in the 1980s being as good as what I saw in 20,000 Leagues. So, yeah, high praise for the special effects team in my book.
Agreed. Wholly agreed. It felt to me, watching it, felt like, save for the underwater sequences that had to be done via film, this almost felt like a play to me, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. It felt like you could see this on stage somewhere.
Yeah.
In that, like, the giant squid, the Kraken, was really well done. I was like, this is top notch. There are like several, like tens of people operating this big, huge,
right.
which is a lot. I mean, like it was enormous, the scale of this thing, on the actual scaled Nautilus that was holding, you know, 20 men at the same time, with incredible
with
in
the
size.
Waves and the rain,
with the waves and the rain and all of the camp, like it, and they got multiple shots and they did, it was pretty incredible.
I wish there was more Kraken in this movie.
Yeah, it is such a small part of the movie, yet it is
they
the
do save
part,
it to the end.
Yeah, they save it for the end, but it is the part that everyone remembers is the Kraken. Like when people left the theaters at the time, they were all talking about the special effects of the squid and how real it looked, and where that was had nothing to do with the movie, really. The whole movie was actually about like man's power and like men are monsters and like how we are the actual, you know, underwater sea monsters and on land monsters, and yet this squid, who was in the movie for 5-7 minutes maybe, was the star of the movie.
Yeah, and it's
it really was like a drama with almost for the first like 90 minutes of the movie, except for a couple of exceptions, and then boom, you've got this monster,
right,
you know, for the last like 20 minutes.
Very much and it's interesting, like, and I think back about like Jules Verne wrote this in 1870. This book alone was light years ahead of its time and what he was able to imagine, these things that are actually we're capable of doing now, of like powering things with atomic energy. And it's really outstanding the way that he really foresaw all this happening. And then Disney, the Disney company, like pioneered a whole new way to shoot movies with this film. It's pretty incredible.
Isn't it very like steampunk too, right? Like,
yeah, Jules Verne is known as sort of the godfather of the steampunk movement, basically, along with like H.G. Wells, I think. So it all sort of happened there. And they leaned into that a little bit artistically with this movie, but I think they almost went with more like a French sort of presentation of it for some reason. Like, it was very gaudy and over the top and like opulent almost inside the submarine itself.
Well, I wonder, and I'm just putting it out there, because I don't know the history of steampunk as an aesthetic.
Mm.
Like, I feel like maybe it's a relatively recent thing. Like, nobody had a name for what Jules Verne was doing.
For sure, yeah.
But now we're like, oh, it's steampunk. But maybe in 1954, Disney didn't know what that was.
Oh, very much no. Yeah, I think steampunk is more, the way that we think of it now is more of a modern term. And we're sort of taking from what they were doing, which was ahead of its time, and like flipping it and imagining like, what if the future actually looked like the past? With futuristic elements, kind of like Tomorrowland within Disney World, right? And Disneyland.
Can I ask Disney experts, where was the Walt Disney Company in the early 1950s with its studio movie making?
This was the first live action film that they shot and produced in the States, and I think it was only like the second live action film that they had done, period. Because they had done Robert Louis Stevenson's Kidnapped first, I think, or Treasure Island, one of the
Treasure
two.
Island, I think, was Treasure the first Island. One.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's pretty early in their...
Yeah, this is very early in the live action.
They had, like I said, the True Life Adventures was kind of like their sort of that's what they were doing at the time, basically a million True Life Adventures, which they won Academy Award after Academy Award for. And so that sort of inspired this movie, in fact, is seeing all of the underwater aspects of the True Life Adventures. Walt Disney was like, this could be a movie, and we happen to have this script, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea. And so it all kind of fell into place that way, interestingly.
All right. And did it pave the way for more live action movies, or?
Well, it didn't. It did well critically. It didn't do well financially necessarily. It was the most expensive movie of its time at the time.
Wow.
And I think it lost $1 million, which at the time is a lot. But I mean, that being said, it still like got a lot of money, because earning $8 million or like in ticket sales is huge, even though they lost $1 million on that $8 million.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at the live action movies that came after this in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you'll see occasionally an action adventure film, but they really kind of pivoted more to like cheaper, to comedies and things that were cheaper to produce.
Right.
That they can make more money on.
Yeah.
And didn't take as long to make as well.
Right. That
just took a long time to make for them.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I'm just thinking about some of those movies. Like, was it the Nutty Professor? Is that a Disney?
Yeah, it would have been like the Shaggy Dog, the Love Bug, all that stuff would have been sort of, Now, well, Love Bug would have been a little bit later, but they all sort of fell into place with each other. It's pretty wild. Well, let's start talking about the cast and crew a little bit. It's not a huge cast. I mean, there's a lot of people in it, but it's a very small cast in that there's only like four main actors, and that would be Kirk Douglas, who plays Master Harpooner Ned Lander, who interestingly was kind of, I mean, he wasn't brand new. He was about 6 years into his career at the time. So he was still making a name for himself in this movie. And this movie kind of catapulted himself into other movies. In fact, he's best known for playing Spartacus in Spartacus in 1960. And I think this role had a big part in him getting that role as well. JT and I were joking earlier that it was almost like they were playing a drinking game in that everyone take a shot every time he takes his shirt off in the movie, because he just couldn't keep his clothes on.
Like, for no reason, he would just take his shirt off.
Yeah, for no reason. Also, fun fact, in the original script, there are no women in this movie at all, and he insisted that there be women at the very beginning, just so he could prove to audiences that he was a ladies' man, basically. Mm-hmm. And so they added two women with no lines, just on his arm at the very beginning of the movie for 35 seconds of the movie, and they let him do it. They were like, okay, great.
It was a, I see what you're going for, Kirk, but when you're spending most of this movie on a submarine with men, and, you say something about a glory hole, that's just...
yep. It happens. It happens. Everything happens. moving on, we talked about him a little bit already. We have James Mason. I don't know how they got him for this movie, but they did. They got James Mason to play Captain Nemo, best known for his roles in Lolita, A Star is Born, and Julius Caesar. An amazing actor. He played such a subdued role in this movie. Like, he was so mysterious and creepy almost in this movie. Mm-hmm. For him being kind of the lead role of this film in a Disney movie.
Well, I think that's the strength of James Mason. He just brings that gravitas without doing a whole lot.
Yeah.
North by Northwest is my favorite. He plays the villain in that.
Oh, that's right. He's great in the movie. That's right.
And he's sort of why it feels like a play, I think, to me, because he's not movie acting. He is just doing as little as possible, and it does epic proportions in the scale of the movie. Moving on, we have Paul Lucas playing Professor Aronnax, best known for Watch on the Rhine, which he actually won the Academy Award for Best Actor in. He was also in the Casino Murder case. I don't know too much about Paul Lucas, but for him also actually being the lead character of the movie wasn't a very big part or a very deep part, I thought. It didn't have a lot of depth to it.
He kind of fades to the background a little bit.
I would
say
that.
It's almost like he starts out and you think he's going to be the central character, and then his character just sort of fades into the background.
That's what I thought.
And Ned and Conceal and Nemo kind of come to the forefront.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Vincent's nodding, everybody.
Yeah, he kind of gets overshadowed by, I'll use my words, he does get overshadowed by the supporting players.
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think so. And then last but not least, we have Peter Lorre, as we said, playing Conceal. if you don't know Peter or Peter Lorre, you do know Peter Lorre. You've heard his voice many, many times, I'm sure.
Hi, I'm Peter Lorre.
That's a very good impression, actually.
Oh, that is really good.
He always plays that kind of creepy guy a little bit, mm-hmm. which was weird to see him in this movie because he wasn't that. But it's still his voice, but he played a very kind of subdued character for the roles he usually plays.
Right, against type, for sure.
Yeah. He was in The Maltese Falcon, which unmistakable role, unmistakable voice that he uses. That Arsenic and Old Lace, Casablanca. He's very LeFou, basically, if you were to compare him to a Disney character. That's
he would be, yes. Peter Lorre would be cast as LeFou today if he was alive.
Yeah. And he does a great job. I really like him. I don't know what it is. He's just a very specific character actor, and he was well suited to this role, I feel like.
He brings such a gentleness to the film, which is like a really nice contrast to all of the manly man stuff that Douglas is bringing to the movie.
Yeah,
that's mm-hmm. a really good point. And I really like their chemistry.
Me too. They were very Gaston and LeFou, basically the two of them together. It was really funny juxtaposition of characters. I liked it. So that's the whole cast. Going into the production crew, we have director Richard Fleischer, who was an epic director, directed so many amazing movies, The Jazz Singer, Soylent Green, Tora, 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 Dr. Dolittle, just to name a few. He directed so many things. I thought did a great job with this movie. I mean, this was, again, as we said, a movie that kind of, Disney didn't know what they were necessarily doing with this movie. Like, they were kind of flying by the seat of their pants. And like, how are we gonna, we have an idea, we have a script, we have the green light, and now go. And so they just kind of made it happen. And he really, pardon the pun, like, helmed the ship really well, I thought. We also then have the screenplay then by Earl Felton. We have cinematography by Franz Planner, art director Harper Goff. Now, we should interestingly talk about Harper Goff as the art director, an uncredited art director, actually, because he was not part of the guild. Is that right, JT?
So at the time, if you were not part of the art director's guild, now he is credited as, I believe, I think he is credited as designing the production in the credits.
Right.
But he was not eligible for any awards or anything because he was not part of the Art Director Guild.
That's right. And Harper Goff, so he designed basically the entire movie. And in fact, the movie wouldn't have happened if Walt Disney hadn't seen his sort of storyboards that he was just sort of just doing for fun, kind of, when he was doing some of these, the True Life Adventure series, which he did a lot of. And, he designed the Nautilus, which is the epic ship that is within, or the submarine, which is, in the movie. Beautiful, beautiful design. He designed all the compartments within the Nautilus. He designed the entire set, from soup to nuts, basically. And he was a huge designer for Disney parks. He basically was one of the main designers for Disneyland in and of itself, and then a lot of Disney World as well. Mm-hmm. So, he doesn't get a lot of credit, unfortunately, for this movie because he wasn't in the guild. But this movie wouldn't have happened without Harper Goff. So,
and he is a Disney legend.
A Disney legend, Harper Goff. That's right.
Yes.
Sounds like it. See, I'm learning things here. Disney, I forget that it's such a... It is a movie studio as old as the MGMs, the Universals, the Warner Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
And it's mark on, like, golden age Hollywood is every bit as important. But I feel like movie buffs, some like me or casual fans, can forget that.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a really... It's interesting to... Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Welcome to the Disney side, Vincent. it's fun over here.
I just watched Fantasia, the original one.
Ooh.
I could talk about that for a long time. There's so much going on.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a big golden age of Disney happening around that time. It's amazing. Moving on, then we have editor Elmo Williams, wonderful name, who edited movies like Roman Holiday, Breakfast at Tiffany's, Cyrano de Bergerac, Death of a Salesman. So really well-known editor, and they chose wisely with him because they knew that they were going to have a mess on their hands if they didn't have a really good editor to really put it all together. We've got sweeping music by Paul Smith, who did a gabillion movies specifically for Disney. The Parent Trap, Pollyanna, Shaggy Dog, The Great Locomotive Chase, Cinderella, Mickey and the Beanstalk, Pinocchio, just 8 million Disney shorts as well. And we should specifically say he was the composer. So he composed all of those. He didn't write like the the songs, the written songs that are in them, but he just soundtracked the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And they did it in a weird way, I think, with this movie, in that they showed him the movie and said, okay, now just fill in the blanks here of what we're missing. So you'll notice that there's a lot of scenes that don't have practical sounds, like the squid. You don't hear the squid mm-hmm. screaming at you or the sounds of the squid hitting the ship. You only hear the music doing that work. Yeah. So Paul Smith did all of that, which is kind of an old way, a really old Hollywood way to tell a story, cool. Which fit in great here. So that's the main cast and crew, everybody.
You forgot Esmeralda the Seal.
I did. The casting crew. Esmeralda the Seal.
Give credit true. Where it's due, Patrick.
It's true. It's true. A funny moment in the movie, for sure. Mm-hmm. Esmeralda the Seal. I don't know that PETA would have a great time knowing what they did with the animals in this movie sometimes, but, you know, what are you gonna do? So, JT, there's some fun... We already went through quite a few of them, but cap off with some fun facts about this movie, and then we'll close out with some final thoughts and shots, and then our overall rating.
Yeah, there are some really fun facts. I think a couple things, we talked about this, but the film was inspired by marine footage and storyboards that Harper Goffin created for the True Life Adventures. Interestingly, this is the first Disney film to be distributed by Buena Vista Productions, which you would see the title card for moving forward in a lot of live-action animated films. Mm-hmm. It's one of the first films to be shot in CinemaScope, which is pretty impressive. It was filmed in the Bahamas and Jamaica and Death Valley. I'm not exactly sure what they filmed. Oh, I guess they filmed the opening scenes, the Western scenes in Death Valley.
Yeah.
Yep. It was one of the most costly films at that time. As we talked about, it cost $9 million to make. It was a commercial hit and sort of a more, it was a critical success and maybe a more moderate commercial success. The New York Times did say that this was as fabulous and fantastic as anything Walt Disney has ever done in cartoons. It was nominated for 3 Oscars. It won 2 of those. It won for color art direction. This, of course, was back in the time when they were separating out categories for black and white and color film. It also won for special effects, rightfully so. and it lost out for best editing. So sorry, Elmo. But interestingly enough, this is where Harper Goff was not adequately awarded, because he was not eligible to receive the Oscar. So he did not get the Academy Award for art direction, even though he should have been included in that. Mm-hmm. And even later on, either they changed the rules or something, but he still wasn't able to get it. This was named one of the top 10 films of 1954 by the National Board of Review. And this is interesting. The shark that approaches Harpooner Ned and Conceal when they discover the treasure underwater was actually an accident. but they kept the footage and used it in the movie. Happy accident for us. Probably not a happy accident for Ned and Conceal.
No, there was a lot of excrement in those suits, yeah. I think, after they saw that shark approach them.
Yeah. This is my most favorite fun fact from the movie, but the organ in the Nautilus that James Mason plays is the organ in the ballroom in Disneyland's Haunted Mansion, and a replica of it is used in Walt Disney World's version of the Haunted Mansion. I love that fun fact.
That's great.
Nerd alert. for those of you who have been just impatiently wondering this entire time we've been talking, a league is considered to be 3 nautical miles at sea, and a nautical mile is about 1.15 land miles. Therefore, if they traveled 20,000 leagues under the sea, they would have traveled about 68,350 miles, enough to circle the earth almost 2.5 times. Did we tell you this movie is a fantasy?
But it's a hell of a title.
Yeah, I mean, what would they say? 4.5 leagues under the sea? Not a great title.
20,000 is a little catchier.
It's a little catchier. A little far-fetched, but I think they were counting that no one was going to know what a league means. Yes.
All the sailors in the audience were like, wait a minute.
Yeah, well, I don't think so. No.
Did either of you go on the 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea attraction at either Disneyland or Magic Kingdom?
No, I'm claustrophobic, too claustrophobic to have done that.
Okay, I did once, and once was plenty.
That's what I hear.
Tell me about it. curious.
It's just they had a recreation of the Nautilus that was partially submerged in this like in this lagoon, and it was in fantasy land, and you would get in, and it was like you were very tightly closed in on this like submarine, and the idea was that you were going underwater, so they would kind of you would feel like you were going underwater, and it was just sort of like an aquarium underwater kind of situation.
Wow.
There was a story to it too. It does not exist in Walt Disney World anymore. The attraction does exist in Disneyland, but it is now Nemo's Submarine Voyage. So it's the same kind of vibe, a little bit more fun aquarium style. And they basically took the Nautilus and sort of retrofitted it to be just a yellow kind of submarine situation.
Interesting. I would definitely give it a shot.
I think if I remember correctly, where it was in the Magic Kingdom is now where Ariel's Undersea Adventure or whatever the long name of that attraction is in the Magic Kingdom. I think that's where that exists today. Yeah.
Okay.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, let's, Vincent, you already sort of gave us that, which is a great perspective of a kaiju perspective. Any last thoughts and shots from where you're coming from on this movie?
Yeah, I did want to mention the Nautilus itself as a sort of, I mean, it's not a living creature, but it's presented as sort of that monstrous sea leviathan, especially at the beginning.
Yeah.
When they don't know what it is.
Right.
And then if you consider, I don't know, I'm getting real film, like maybe metaphorically too far on a limb. But, you know, James Mason, he's the brains of the ship. It's his heart in there too. And, you know, certainly if he's a human monster inhabiting this crazy steampunk, scary looking shell of a monster, you know, I think you could extend the metaphor to the Nautilus itself being a monster.
That's an interesting perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. You could almost go so far as to say, like, he started to turn into such a monster himself that, when the actual monster did attack the ship, they didn't know what to do with an actual monster. Like, they were pretending to be monsters this entire time. Mm-hmm. And then when they were attacked by a monster, they were sort of at a loss and needed the help of the people that they were putting in jail instead. And so there's an interesting, like, power dynamic happening there. This movie is, pardon the pun, deeper than you really think it is at first glance, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the themes of power and helping, you know, how James Mason is playing the sort of the archetype for later James Bond villains. He's sequestered alone on this ship, and he wants to save humanity, but through the most destructive means possible.
Yeah.
Oof. So what's the morality?
It's
there?
Like you become the very thing you're trying to destroy that you hate.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, very that. Yeah, because he thinks he's saving people, but he's actually sacrificing people. And oof.
Ooh, boy. So the moral of this movie is the real monsters were the friends we made along the way.
No. That's 100% what it is.
That's
right.
That's what I thought.
Love it. It's a whale of a tale.
It's a whale of a tale.
Oh, boy.
I like it. Well, let's get into overall scores then. So let's start with, as an overall movie, 1 to 5. JT, let's start with you. What would you give this movie?
You know, as a movie, I'm going to give it a 3.5.
Okay. That's pretty high ranking, actually. I feel like I'm not surprised by it, but I think it's you know.
I'm gonna give it a 3.5.
I like it, Vincent. How about you?
I'm gonna give it a 4.
Interesting. Interesting.
Yeah, it's my type of, you know, devil may care type action adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's totally fair. I would say 3.5 to 4, specifically for like special effects and like care of the movie. I'm docking it a little bit because of the problematic scene within the movie, for the horror movie. Yeah. So that's where I would land it. Yeah. What about on an inclusivity scale then, JT, 1 through 5?
I can't give it a 0, so I give it a 1.
You can give it a 0. Absolutely.
No, well, you know what? I'm going to give it a 0 then, because
this is our show. I mean, we can do what we want.
First of all, the only two women in this movie are not allowed to speak and are just depicted as arm candy for the male.
Yeah.
And I mean, anyone who's non-white in this film is depicted as, you know, a savage cannibal. And everybody else is white men. So yeah, a 0. I can't. Yeah.
Agreed. Yeah. Negative 10 for inclusivity scale on this one. Yeah. Vincent?
Yeah, I'll give it a 1.
Okay, I won. Just to be different. Okay, okay. cis hetero white man. You
yeah,
get
I gotta stir in the pot here.
Oh Lord. Okay, and then last but not least, if gays are rating the D here, what's the queer scale that you're going to give it on?
I mean, I'm going to give it a 4 just because Kirk Douglas takes a shirt off every 5 minutes for literally no plot reason.
Oh, there's a reason.
There was a reason. And
no, I don't
mean. A queer baiting scale, it was definitely a 5 out of 5, yeah. I think. Yeah, but also, it was just a very opulent and dramatic movie.
I was going to say, and I have to say, every movie that James Mason is ever in, he gives off, there's a little bit of a queer-codedness happening.
Yes, he was very, like a Scar kind of a character, yeah. And just a subtle, like, yeah. Am I a bad guy? Am I not a bad guy?
Yeah, because it happens in North by Northwest, it happens in this. Maybe not so much A Star Is Born, not so much in Lolita, for sure.
No.
But yeah, I'm going to give it a 5. I'm going to give it a 4, a solid 4.
Yeah. And not because of like rainbow inclusivity, but because it's just very queer. It's a very queer movie.
It is a very queer movie. It's a lot of men on a submarine.
Yeah.
Right.
It's sailors.
You know, it's not subtle, all the phallic symbols everywhere.
The tentacles, I mean, come on.
Master Harpooner.
I mean, yeah. Okay.
You can edit this stuff out.
Nope. It's all staying.
Okay. Well, there's a part. You know, they're sitting around the table and they're eating the food that James Mason has provided. And I'm going to tie this into Moby Dick as well because he mentions that the milk is actually sperm whale milk.
Oh, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. I forgot about that.
If you've ever read Moby Dick, there's a lot of queer readings into that book as well. Mm-hmm. And one really well-known passage in Moby Dick is all about the sperm and plunging their hands into it and turning it into something. Right. So I was just like, you know,
yep,
there it is.
And who among us Tweedles hasn't read Moby Dick?
I mean,
me, I'm that Tweedle.
Daily. I read it daily. Actually.
Yes. Just a passage every morning when you wake up.
Absolutely. Amazing. All right. So it sounds like overall, I think our average score on inclusivity, queer scale, and as a movie, we're at about a 2.5, I think.
Because
we rated it so low on inclusivity. Yeah. So that feels about right. Yeah. And how does it stack up if you had a 1 through 5 on a kaiju scale for you, Vincent?
Oh, that's a good question. You're welcome. I mean, it's not actually super monster heavy as you may think it is through Reputation. I certainly went in thinking that the giant squid would be a far larger aspect of the film.
Yeah.
It's not. Now, the scene it's in is dynamite. But, you know, is it a monster movie? No. Does it have a monster in it? Yes.
Deep. This is much like my life. Oh, there's a monster in it, but it is not a monster movie. That monster is me. Well, thank you very much, Vincent, for joining us today. We're honored to have you. Remind everyone at home where they can find you and your podcast.
Yes, thank you, Patrick, JT, and all you Tweedles out there. You can listen to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews pretty much anywhere you podcast. You can visit our website, campkaijumoviereviews.com, for links to our episodes, other blog reviews we're typing up on a weekly basis, and information about our Patreon if you're interested in that sort of thing. So, that's Camp Kaiju, and I really can't thank you guys enough for having me on.
You really can't.
I can't.
But we will link all of your Patreon and your website and your Instagram on our show notes, so you can find it there. You don't have to memorize it all right now. Tweedles at home. Well, that was 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, folks. Any last words before we head into Quick D?
Nope. Great. Excellent.
Somewhere Kirk Douglas has taken off his shirt and filling in the silence.